because genocide against native people is still going on today all over the world.
Native Solidarity News. It's about you, too. CKUT, CKDU, CFBEX, CFUV, CHFN, CHLY, CHMA, CHSR, CJLY, CJSF, CJSW, Radio 90.
All right, welcome to Native Solidarity News. My name is Arkar. I'm here with JJ. How are you doing, JJ?
Pretty good, Arkar. How are you doing?
Good, good, good. So we're going to get right to our a piece of music, and then we're going to go to our feature with some news thrown in there.
America. I'm afraid of the world. God is an American. 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 God is an American.
We're going to jump right into the news here at Native Solidarity News. And so, what do you got for us?
Well, our first story tonight, Urquhart, comes to us from courtesy of the Turtle Island Native Network with files from Now Magazine of Toronto. Canada's new minority government leader, Stephen Harper, and his 26 cabinet members were sworn in yesterday in Ottawa. The new Conservative government's Minister of Indian Affairs and federal interlocutor of Métis and non-status Indians is Jim Prentice of Calgary. When in opposition, Jim Prentice was the critic for this particular portfolio and consistently attacked then-Indian Affairs Minister Andy Scott. During the election campaign, when it became apparent that the historic Kelowna-BC agreements might be in jeopardy under a Harper government, Jim Prentice assured Aboriginal leaders that was not the case. Mr. Prentice is a lawyer and was a commissioner of the Indian Claims Commission for Canada for 10 years. He also finished a close second to Peter MacKay for the leadership bid of the old Progressive Conservative Party in 2003. The Assembly of First Nations National Chief Phil Fontaine has welcomed the appointment of the new Indian Affairs Minister, commenting on his support of First Nations issues in the House of Commons, and saying that he has demonstrated a willingness to work with First Nations to further understand and advance their issues. Also, Métis Nation of Ontario President Tony Belcourt welcomed Mr. Prentice, stating, quote, Mr. Prentice is well-grounded in his knowledge of the Aboriginal peoples of Canada and has a demonstrated sensitivity to our concerns. We have every expectation that he will develop a good rapport with our people and will take a very constructive approach to addressing our issues, end quote. Jim Flaherty has also been appointed as finance minister of the new cabinet. Jim Flaherty was Solicitor General in the late 1990s under Mike Harris's Conservative government in Ontario, and during his tenure voted against an inquiry into the death of Dudley George. Dudley George was murdered by an Ontario provincial police officer during a protest at Ipperwash, and he was unarmed at the time. An inquiry has since been undertaken. During his time in Harris's government, Flaherty was blasted by Aboriginal groups for his position on homelessness, as well as comments that suggested Aboriginal people were, quote, sucking up, unquote, healthcare resources and diverting them from real people in real communities. So that one's not so promising. The Conservatives have suggested they will resurrect the First Nations Governance Act to address issues of self-governance and accountability. Mr. Prentice has also said he favors a long overdue overhaul of the Indian Act. He has said that true self-government is what must replace the Act. He has also promised greater accountability to ensure the billions of dollars allocated for First Nations are spent so they actually make a difference in the communities. So obviously I think the onus falls on Mr. Prentice to prove himself in the next however many years this government lasts, but only time will tell what they actually do.
Well, I give it about 12 months before someone decides to smack them down. These guys are new, so I'm willing to give them the benefit of the doubt until they decide to show their true colors.
We'll see. I guess we'll see. But we'll keep our eyes open, and here at Native Sahli News, we'll try and keep you abreast of the issues as they emerge. The next story we have is also from Canada, and is also from Turtle Island Native Network, and also with files from sistersinspirit.org. On January 30th, the trial of 56-year-old Robert Willie Picton got underway. Picton stands accused of the first-degree murder of 27 women, most of whom disappeared from Vancouver's notorious downtown east side. If convicted, Picton will be Canada's worst-ever serial killer, and this has been the largest murder investigation in Canadian history, according to some sources. The charges are based on evidence uncovered by police on his pig farm in Port Coquitlam, which is outside of Vancouver City. Many of the women Picton is accused of murdering were Aboriginal, and his case has brought attention to an issue that Aboriginal and community groups have been talking about for years. Rates of violence against Aboriginal women are alarmingly high, and the police attention to such cases is often lacking, to say the least. The Native Association, Women's Association of Canada, has estimated that over 500 Aboriginal women have gone missing in the last 20 years. And statistics have shown that Aboriginal women are 5 times more likely to die as a result of violence than any other group of women in Canada. Picton's arrest was the result of an investigation into the disappearance of over 50 women from Vancouver's downtown east side spread over 20 years. Observers have noted that had police been taking these disappearances seriously from the beginning, many lives could have been saved.
Well, it goes to the case of, like, if they're, like, rich lawyer women disappearing, you know, female lawyers disappearing, or good earners, you know, taxpayers disappearing, then it's just going to be, like, oh, yeah, we'll get right on it, you know, but these are sex workers.
Yeah, it's true.
And it's unfortunate, you know, it's like sex workers have that stigma of, like, not everyone is going to pay attention to them.
Well, they're not even looked at as full citizens or as full people. It's alarming. Anyways, it's...
Yeah.
And so hopefully this will change it. I mean,
yeah.
Maybe this will be the watershed, because it's really disgusting what's happened. I mean... Well.
I was speaking to a sociologist about this particular subject, and he was telling me about how, you know, it's very hard to keep track of sex workers, because sometimes they just leave town.
Yeah.
And a lot of the time, violent acts don't get reported, like rapes and stuff like that. So I understand, you know, the police's, you know, position on, like, you know, how difficult it is, but they could definitely have tried more, there's no question.
Mm-hmm. I think it also goes a lot towards the legalization of prostitution, because if you have people registered,
it would be so much easier to deal with the situation if there's a registry.
If they hadn't forced it underground already.
Yeah.
Yeah, and made those women so vulnerable. But anyways,
I have.
I believe you also have a.
Yeah, I have another one. One news piece. This was given to me by Dan. On January 20th, 13 Mohawk men were sentenced for participation in a riot, forcible confinement of police, and unlawful assembly, with sentences far greater than what was requested by the prosecution. While 6 of the 7 who were sentenced to jail time are now out on conditions while the case goes to appeal, Gary Gabriel remains a political prisoner because his resistance was in a breach of previously imposed court conditions. In addition to the defendant's appeal, a Crown prosecutor in Montreal is also appealing the verdicts, claiming the judge should never have accepted the self-defense arguments made by the defense lawyers, and that without it, all 24 defendants should have been found guilty. The current sentences are as followed. For rioting and forcible confinement, Gordon Lazor and Gary Gabriel, 15 months in prison. Robert and Bradley Gabriel, 12 months in prison. Hubert Nelson, 6 months in prison. Alistair Nicholas, 4 months in prison, and Terry Yaxley, 3 months in prison. For unlawful assembly, Francois Pissonneau got a $1,000 fine, T. Nelson McDonald, $600 fine, Joey Day, $500 fine, and 50 hours community service. And Milton Gabriel, Keith Cree, Stuart Conway all got conditional discharges with a $500 charitable donation. This February 11th at 12 p.m., there will be a rally and march from Oka, ferry up the hill to Gunasataki, demanding the freedom for Gary Gabriel, the political prisoner, and for an inquiry. They're asking for an inquiry into the January 12, 2004 illegal invasion. The IPSM will be organizing rides to Oka if you need a ride, or if you can provide one, contact Pascal at 514-933-9561. The newly elected Grand Chief of Gunasataki Band Council, Steve Bonspiel, is in support of the community's demand for a public inquiry. He held a press conference January 19th, clearly articulating this demand, which some mainstream media spun with headlines, Grand Chief Calls for Inquiry. You know, they can't even say his name. For this media coverage, this is an indication of the campaign for a public inquiry will be an uphill battle, irregardless of the fact that Shango has come forward regarding the implementation of the S-24 or Gunasataki Interim Land-Based Governance Act. The traditional Longhouse people have made their objections to this agreement clear. On December 21st, 2005, the Department of Canadian Colonialism, Indian and Northern Affairs Canada, went ahead and authorized $825,000 to Chief Clarence Simon as the Chief Mohawk Negotiator to move forward on S-24 and a tripartite policing agreement. Indian Affairs makes it clear that all money is $100,000 for community for communication, $260,000 for negotiations, and $140,000 for litigation, including contests of the June 25, 2005 election, are to be used for the defense of the validity and set agreements, not to oppose or educate the people about them. In addition, these funds, however, Canada has committed an, as yet, undetermined amount for the for a healing process within the community. If Judge Nicole Duval Hessler's demand that the Gunasataki defendants apologize to their attackers is any indication of what Canada regards as healing, some more colonial paternalism is surely to follow. The S-24 will municipalize Gunasataki and impose a property tax regime on all properties. The federal government were supposed to hand over after the Oka Crisis of 1990 and that are currently occupied by the Ganaheka freedom fighters. They have never legally been transferred because the government made this transfer contingent on quid pro quo of S-24. Once S-24 is in place, these properties will be subject to seizure by the Band Council as a harbinger of things to come. Warrior Dennis Nicola has already been served with an eviction notice. Your support is needed. Contact us at ipsm@resist.ca. Now we're gonna go up to a little bit of music here. Now what do we got here? Yeah, we got an oldie but a goodie. This one is Diamond Sun by Glass Tiger.
Oh, you must bow down, he said, for to you.
All right, that was Glass Tiger, Diamond Sun. They really were able to tell the story well there. All right, so what we got is our feature. It's an old one. We had to delve into our archives for this one, but it's an important aspect, and it's because it's Black History Month. This one is about Native and Black Native and Black liberation. So you're listening to Native Solidarity News here on CKUT.